Okay, Boker Tov. Hope everybody's doing well, enjoying. Pleasure to welcome you to our health. We're going to do here, as you know, we're going to discuss mental health, which, as we mentioned last night, especially in the post-COVID world, is a very serious issue. I don't know, 1 in 5 people, they say, in Canada, I'm sure it's no different than anywhere else, has mental health issues, and we know how serious an issue it is. So we're going to have Rabbi Steinberg. We'll speak first, give some of the halachic issues background, and he needs no introduction. After 14 years and after last night, Rabbi Steinberg needs no introduction. And Baruch Hashem, it's really a pleasure. We are honored that he comes year in and year out, really the premier expert we feel in the world on Jewish medical ethics. Miksot Shracho Lepanav, and thank you very much. And you and your wife always... a pleasure to be with you, and thank you for hosting our children in Israel, and we look forward to many years together. We also have with us today for the first time, welcome to Torah Motion, Dr. Debbie Ackerman, who is a social worker with many years working in addiction, recovery, and trauma. She's a wife, a mother, a grandmother. She has 11 biological children and 8 chosen children. I asked her how many kids live at home. She said she's not sure. They come and go. They come and go at the same time, in and out. So really amazing. She's been teaching for many years. It's worthwhile you hear her amazing story and power, and how we can move forward, overcoming the challenges that life brings before us. And it's a pleasure to welcome back Dr. Michelle Friedman. You spoke in Stowe and in Lake Placid, I believe. And for now, it's a... 3 times, not in a row, but a chazaka. Dr. Friedman is really one of the leading psychiatrists in our community, in the Frum community. She is head of the pastoral program at Yeshivat Chovei Torah. She holds the Stephen and Sharon Lieberman Chair in Pastoral Counseling. She's associate professor of clinical psychiatry at the Icahn School of Medicine, and really does tremendous work in our community. And it's a pleasure to have all 3 of you and all of you. And Vakasha, Rabbi Steinberg.
Good morning, everyone. Can you move the next slide? Actually, the slides are more for me than for you, because I don't remember what I want to say the next step. If it's stuck, we can go home. Okay, let me just start with a brief introduction to what I'm going to say. Mental health is a complicated issue, certainly for life, for lifestyle, but also from a halachic point of view. The next one. Next one. Okay. So there are problems in defining mental illnesses or disorders, both clinically, psychiatrically, and psychologically, and especially halachically. There is some order since the DSM societies have tried to do some order in the different presentations of mental illnesses. Here is a partial list. Either you go by diagnosis or by etiologies, and everyone, I'm sure, knows these and other types of mental disorders. There are various degrees. There are various types of treatments. Some help more, some help less, and we'll see what the halacha relates to compared to what the modern psychiatry and psychology is dealing with. Next, please. So halachic terminology does not distinguish etiologies or a specific symptomatology. In general, the equivalent of what we call today psychiatric disorders is probably what Chazal called shote, and what we call mental retardation or mental disability or whatever appropriate name is used nowadays is a peti. Peti is someone whose understanding, whose comprehension, whose intelligence is below normal. And shote is someone who might be very intelligent, but his behavior is abnormal. Next. So if we compare the approach of modern medicine and halacha to mental disorders, medicine is etiology related and symptomatology related, and the definitions are according to either the etiology or the group of symptoms. Whereas halacha looks at all these options on a functional level. Is the person functional or is he not functional? Is he functional because his mental capacity is disturbed and therefore he can't function appropriately, or his intelligence is below normal and he can't function properly? Sometimes many symptoms can be regarded as significant from a halachic point of view, although etiology related, they are very different. And that really doesn't matter for halacha. It doesn't matter if he is manic or if he is aggressive or if he has any other specific diagnosis from a medical point of view, as long as the outcome is such that he can or cannot function for a specific halachic issue. So it's a very different approach, both by halacha and medicine. Next. So halacha divides the shote, or the psychiatrically disturbed person, into three various situations. One is shote lechol davar v'inyan, someone who is totally psychiatric, he can't understand what film is, he can't understand what Shabbos is, he can't understand what murder is or what theft is. He is a shoyte lechol davar, and because of that, he is exempt from all the mitzvot and all the obligations. If he harmed someone, he is innocent. We can't punish him because he didn't do it willingly. So that is shoyte lechol davar v'inyan. Another situation is shote ledavar echad, which means that on a specific task, he is incompetent, unreliable. But in other matters, he can be relatively fine. So he will be responsible for the others, but irresponsible for the specific disorder that he is shote ledavar echad. And the third category is itim chalim, itim shote, someone who has mood change or has changes in his behavior, either due to medication or due to his inherent illness. So sometimes he's perfectly fine and sometimes he's totally out. So that is called itim halim. Halim means healthy. Itim shote, that he is abnormal. We find it in epileptics, we find it in manic depressive, we find it in depressed people, that they have better and worse times. And he's judged, as I said earlier, according to the symptomatology at the time that he has to be judged. Next. Excuse me. Example of a second one might be that in certain aspects, he is not coherent, but in others he can function. There can be a manic depressive that is in a stage that now he is okay, and yesterday he was not. Things can change in this way. It's not a very frequently encountered situation, medically speaking, but halachically that is a definition. We'll see it in a minute. Okay. Now the Gemara in Chagiga defines ezeu shote gamur האמור בכל מקום. As we said, there are three levels, שותה גמור, שותה לדבר אחד, איתים חלים, איתים שותה, and the Gemara in Chagiga talks about a שותה that is a total שותה. He is incompetent for anything. Who is this person? As according to the pshat in the Gemara, that's a person who fulfills four symptoms. היוצא יחידי בלילה, he walks at night alone, הלן בבית הקברות, he sleeps in cemeteries, המקרע את כסותו, someone who tears his garments, והמאבד כל מה שנותנים לו, he loses everything that he is getting. Now obviously, these are examples that pertain to the time and are only heads of similar symptomatology, which everyone agrees that would be included even in those days. We'll talk about what happens nowadays, but that is the situation. So for instance, Hayotze Yechidi Balayla, maybe someone who crosses streets without paying attention to cars, is wandering without any purpose, and he loses addresses. So it's like walking at night that he can't find his way. So that is an example of several behaviors. Halan bebet akvarot is actually someone who withdraws from society. Maybe he's depressed. Some people who stop eating. These are examples that come from this heading of halan bebet akvarot. Hamekare at ksuto can be someone who doesn't care for his garments, he doesn't wash, he doesn't shave, and he might act violently. And ma'abed kol ma shenotnim lo, actually is forgetful, he misplaces things, or he forgets where he put. So these are the examples from the Gemara itself. Next. Okay, now the question is, we just defined shote lechol davar, which means he is the first category, a complete shote. The question in amongst the Rishonim was, is it enough one of the four signs, or you need all of them to define him as a shote halachically? Also, it is acceptable that all these four signs, which may be either signs or examples for signs, are within the framework of non-competency. But if someone walks at night because he has a meeting in the next door, that doesn't mean that he is automatically a shoiter, right? It has to be done within the context of being incompetent. Some poskim rule that only these signs define a shoiter. So if someone is doing other bizarre behaviors, he would not be regarded a shoite, even though a psychiatrist would give him a certificate that he is a full shoite. But if he doesn't fulfill one or the four, he would not be halachically a shoite. But the majority of poskim, and including the Rambam, say that these are just examples, and you can derive from these examples many other behaviors that fulfill the same purpose as these signs are. And importantly, nowadays, if a shoite fulfilled all the criteria, but he is medicated, and when he is medicated, he behaves normally, then he is regarded as a normal person. Because again, the diagnosis didn't change. He is still schizophrenic. He is still paranoid. But because he's controlled by the medication, the symptoms don't show. And as we said, halachically, the symptoms count and not the original diagnosis. So a person that was diagnosed clinically and behaviorally as a shoite and was successfully treated, from now on, he's not a shoite, because we go by the symptoms as they are current. Next. So this is a summary from the Rambam that everyone relates to when talking halachically how to define a shote. Lo shote shu ma'alech arum u'meshaber kelim v'zorek avanim bilvad. Not only these four signs that the Gemara gave, these constitute a shote.
אלא כל מי שנטרפה דעתו ונמצאת דעתו משובשת תמיד בדבר מן הדברים, אף על פי שהוא מדבר ושואל כעניין בשאר דברים, הרי זה פסול ובכלל שוטים יחשב. That has to do with הלכות עדות. A witness has to be fully competent in order for his witness to be acceptable, but if he behaves strangely, if he behaves like someone who is mad and his mind is always disturbed, he cannot be a witness because we can't rely on what he is saying if it is really a sign of competency. And the Rambam adds something which, in my opinion, that is true even nowadays with all the advancements of psychiatry. דבר זה לפי מה שיראה הדיין, שאי אפשר לכוון הדעת בכתב. Says the Rambam, I can't describe to you the definition in a written form because there's no way to write what exactly is a shoyte. That is something that needs an assessment. The assessment can be done by a psychiatrist, can be done by a judge, can be done by a teacher, doesn't matter, but someone has to assess it, and we can't really write it out. So indeed, nowadays, we have written diagnoses, we have the DSM, and we have other sorts of definitions, but when it comes to an individual patient, it is still a judgmental situation by someone who is an expert in the field, again, either a psychiatrist or a dayan. And we see in many instances in courts and in rabbinic courts that if two psychiatrists give evidence on a specific person, you get two different opinions, whether he is or isn't competent or non-competent, because this is a judgmental situation, and that is the halacha. That's how you rule on such matters. So what does it mean da'ato meshubeshet tamid bedavar min advarim that the Rambam says? That means that he has a distorted thought process and communication problems. And again, it can vary. The degree can be different. The occasions where it happens can be different. And therefore, it's a matter of judgment. Who is this person? Practically speaking, nowadays, both in secular courts of law and in rabbinic courts, the judges always seek for a competent psychiatric evaluation because they can't know enough to make such decisions. But it is not always that the judges would accept a psychiatric opinion if they feel that for this particular situation, the situation is different. And it's up to the judge to make judgment. Next. Now, a famous story occurred in the 18th century in 1766. It's called the Kleve Get. And the story there was a very outstanding story, but the interest of it, besides the interesting story per se, is that all the gedolim of that era discussed definitions of a shoyte in order to apply to this particular situation, because as you know, a get can be given only by a competent husband. If he is incompetent, his get is invalid, and the woman is not divorced. So in order to assess this particular situation, the Noida Biuda, the Vilna Goen, the Chacham Tzvi, really all the famous names that we can think of, all wrote their opinion on this particular instance. And based on that, nowadays, we clarified some of the definitions. So the story was that a newly married man in Mannheim in Germany declared a week after marriage that he is in danger because of a secret issue. He wouldn't disclose why he feels that he is in danger, and he must leave Germany to London. And in order not to render his newly met wife, he wants to give her a speedy get
so she will be free and he will run to London. That was his complaint. The couple arrived at a border town between Dutch and Germany, which was called Kleves. That was the city. And it happened that the rabbi in this city was Rabbi Israel Lifshitz, who was the grandfather of the Tiferet Israel, whose name was also Rabbi Israel Lifshitz, but that's his grandfather. And this Rabbi Lifshitz listened to the story of this fellow. The fellow disclosed to him what his secretive danger is, and he evaluated that the reason is right and that the person at the moment was competent. Based on that, he wrote a speedy get and the husband ran away. There was a continuation to the story, but the question was this get written by a competent person? It came to the rabbis of Mannheim, the city that this fellow came from, and they claimed that they know him from before, that he is insane. And therefore, the whole story is a made-up story, and the get is invalid. What? Right, but maybe at A, I don't know where he got married, maybe not in Mannheim, and wherever he covered up that there was a problem. I don't know. You're right, but that was the fact. That's what they said. And that created, and obviously Rabbi Lifshitz claimed that he saw the man, he spoke to him, he knows what the secret is, and to him it's valid. So two books were written on that case. A book by the opponents of the get, written by Rabbi Simon of Copenhagen. I don't know why he chose to write a book, but he wrote it obviously based on tshuvas that he assembled from all the Gdoilim, as I said, the Noida Biuda, the Vilna Gaon, and others, that invalidated the get, and a book written by Rabbi Lifshitz himself, following this book and refuting all the questions and validating the get. So that all the discussion in these two books is a basis to what we are discussing nowadays, halachically, when such difficult cases come before the court. Next. So the Rambam, again, when he's talking about, we saw the previous halacha, this is Seif Yud, we saw previously Seif Tet. Seif Tet talks about a psychiatric situation. Seif Yud talks about a mentally retarded situation. And about the mentally retarded, says the Rambam, haptaim beyoter, those who are seriously mentally retarded, she'ein makirim dvarim shesotrim ze et ze, they can't see contradictions in statements, ולא יבינו ענייני הדבר כדרך שמבינים שאר עם הארץ, and they don't understand normal, mundane situation, וכן המבועלים והנחפזים בדעתם המשתגעים ביותר, הרי אלו בכלל השוטים, ודבר זה לפי שיראה הדיין שאי אפשר לכוון הדעת בכתב. Again, the statement is, I'm giving you a general description, but when it comes individually, you must assess it yourself, and I can't write you a formula that will apply to every case. Next. Now, I want to take one mental disorder which is frequently encountered nowadays, and we are not there yet, but probably a good percentage here will be defined in this situation, and that's dementia. Some may show already early signs, but I won't go into it. So dementia, by definition, is the loss of cognitive functioning, thinking, remembering, reasoning, behavioral ability to such an extent that it interferes with a person's daily life and activity. So if someone forgets a name and after a while, at 2 a.m, he says, oh, now I recall what I wanted to say, that's not so terrible. But if he can't conduct his daily life, that becomes an issue.
And these include all these higher function tasks like memory, thought processing, language, visual perception, and so on. Some people with dementia cannot control their emotions and their personalities may change. And most commonly, the dementia is Alzheimer's, but there are many other reasons for dementia. We, in general, say he is Alzheimer's, but it's not always the right pathological diagnosis, but it doesn't matter for the daily life. Next. So, as you probably all know, clinically, there's a division of the stages of dementia. The initial stages are things that many encounter, but the deeper the dementia becomes, the more severe the issues come. The stages can last in between 4, 10, or maybe even more years between one stage and the other. And the final stage, which in this category is stage 7, is already a stage that can be regarded as a dying situation, as an end-of-life situation, but not every Alzheimer patient is a dying patient. Although we all are dying people, right? No one will live forever. And by the way, there's a misnomer in the English language when we talk about a terminal patient. A terminal patient means that he's going to die, which means that if I am not a terminal patient at the moment, I am an eternal person, right? The opposite of terminal is eternal. Doesn't make sense. I'm terminal now the same way as I'll be in 120 years, the day before I die, I'll be then terminal and I'm now terminal. So terminal is really a misnomer. And we in Israel, at least in the law, we took it out and we don't use it. But anyway, the stage that comes to the final stages of advanced dementia is a dying stage already, and it has ramifications in the other room where they discuss end-of-life issues. So this is the clinical setup. Next. So what are some of the issues that relate to what I call Shote Gamur, the first category out of the three? It's not Shote Ledavar Echad. It's not Itim Chalim, Itim Shote. He is constantly, on every matter, a Shote. He can't make judgments. He can't remember. His behavior is aberrant and so on. So such a person is exempt from all mitzvot and obligations, even rabbinical ones. He doesn't put on tefillin, he doesn't pray, he's not qualified for a minyan, and so on. And if he violates Shabbos or Kashrus, he is not liable, because this is only for people who can judge. If he can't judge, he is an anus rachmona patri. On the other side, it is permissible to use any therapy if available, including forbidden foods and desecrating Shabbat or feeding him on Yom Kippur, because all these situations may turn out to be a pikuach nefesh, because he doesn't understand why not eat on Yom Kippur, why not write on Shabbos. He can become very disturbed to a level of being pikuach nefesh, and therefore, if we can handle it in a way that he will not desecrate Shabbat or eat on Yom Kippur, fine. But if he does it, we should be lenient with him, because he is exempt anyway, and that may worsen his situation. If such a person requires a hospitalization, it's preferable to put him in a place where kosher food would be provided. But if it's unavailable and for his good, he should be institutionalized, then even if they feed non-kosher food, we can put him there. In Israel, I don't know here, but in Israel, there was a time where male and female were in the same room, because they are anyway psychiatric. That halachically is wrong. And since Fidat went on, now there are separate units for males and females, even though they are not responsible for their deeds. Now, a very complicated situation occurs when one of the spouses becomes totally demented before they separated. So if the woman becomes totally demented, then there is a way to free the man from this marriage by what's called Heter Me'er Rabbanim. 100 rabbis sign that the woman is incapable of keeping the get, and they as if stay married, but the man can remarry another woman. The idea behind it is that midoraita, but biblically, a man can marry as many women as he wants. So the fact that she is not functioning and he wants a woman that will be a partner, he can marry another woman. But since Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom, a man is not allowed to marry more than one woman, but this is an outstanding situation where he can't live this way. So it goes back to the biblical situation where he is permitted to have another woman, but that is a very unusual circumstance where there is a requirement of 100 rabbonim to agree. 100 rabbonim is usually just a stample. Most of the 100 rabbonim don't go into the details. They rely on whoever is the one that went into it deeply and decided that indeed the requirements are that the woman is totally incapable of leading a household and that it is incurable. Because if her situation is transient or temporary, then no heter me'er rabbanim will be given. He'll have to wait until she is cured. Or if there is a cure, even a partial cure to a situation where it's relatively okay to live with her, then there will be no heter me'er rabbanim. We're talking about a woman that is totally incapable and it's irreversible and untreatable. But when it happens the other way around, that is a major problem. Because if the man becomes totally incapable, the woman is not allowed to marry another man because biblically she can't have two men. That is Giluy Arayot. So the Heter Me'er Rabbanim won't help because Me'er Rabbanim can't override a biblical prohibition. So she's unfortunately stuck with this situation. There were some suggestions to try to ameliorate this terrible occurrence. One is that we said that Alzheimer has stages. When the man enters the initial stages, it is advisable for him to give a get at that stage, because at that stage he's still comfortable to give a get, and in this way he can free his wife. However, if he gives a full get, then they have really to separate, and that is a bad time for the man to separate when he becomes dependent. And obviously, he, and in most cases, sometimes the woman is happy to get rid of him, and that's a good excuse. But in most cases, a good wife would like to support and to be still of help, so he can give a get on tonight. He can write a get now, but it will become effective when he will become totally incompetent. So in this case, the get will happen at the time that it is needed, but if you'll wait for the time, you won't be able to give the get. So that's called get on tonight. There are other situations. There was a famous, and I'll finish by that, there was a famous case in Tzfat where a man became totally incompetent, demented, and the woman, and they didn't prepare anything before, and the Bezdin ruled a very unusual ruling that the get can be given by a shaliach, although he is incompetent and he can't make shaliach, but there is a rule, zachin la'adam shelo befanav. You're allowed to merit, to benefit someone, if it's for his benefit, even if he is not the one that is doing it himself. And the assumption of the Beis Din there in Tzfat was that every husband would be more than happy to free his wife, and she shouldn't get stuck with him when he's totally incompetent and she could start her life from beginning. So that was a schus for him to free her from him. That was their assumption. That was refuted by all rabbis in Israel. In fact, the president of this rabbinic court was already in process to become a dayan in the Supreme Rabbinic Court, and they stopped it because they thought it was a major mistake. There were sides for this and for this. There's a whole story around it. I don't want to elaborate on this here, but that ruling, at the moment at least, is not acceptable. So if there was no preparation for the get, and the man all of a sudden became demented or in a vegetative state or whatever situation that he can't give a get now, then the woman is actually stuck. I remember a case where a healthy person went for a minor surgery, I think appendectomy or whatever, and it became complicated, and he ended up to be in a persistent vegetative state. The woman was a young woman, the man was also in his 30s, and he could live with it another 70 years. And she stuck for so many years. It was a well-to-do couple, and he was put in a nursery home where he got excellent treatment, and obviously he could live as long as he was designed to, but being totally incompetent. So one of the rabbis, I won't mention his name, said there's no obligation to put him in a good facility. Put him in a less good facility. They'll continue to treat him the best they can, but his survival rate will be much decreased, and that will be a way for the woman to get freed. And I think they did it, and it took 2-3 years, and he died. I'm not recommending such a solution, but I'm telling you how difficult the situation is, that even to such a degree, there are people who want to do it. Thank you.
Can that marriage be annulled, or is she stuck as an
abnormal? If it's clear that at the time of the marriage she didn't know that he has a psychiatric disorder or a genetic disease or a cancer or whatever, and it wasn't disclosed, then it is invalid. You don't need a get. The whole kiddush is, it's called kiddushei ta'ut or mekach ta'ut, and vice versa. If the woman didn't disclose a serious defect, then it's annulled automatically. Why? Oh, you mean the cleavaget?
Yeah.
You mean the cleavaget? No. So again, I don't know what it was when he got married. Maybe at the time he was okay and he became... Right. Maybe something happened right after the marriage. I don't know. I don't know the story. If it would be clear that he was incompetent at the time of the marriage to a degree that he requires a get, then he didn't require a get. That's true. No. The tnai is objective. The tnai is, if you become totally incompetent, then the get starts from today.
No, they are married, right? And both are fine. After 10 years, he shows signs of dementia. So he writes her a get that the get is valid at the time, if the time comes that I'll become totally incompetent and it will be retroactively in fact at the day that I signed the get. There are many such conditions in the Gemara. If here's your get, if I'll arrive in 30 days to a certain place, if I'll arrive there, then the get is get. If I won't arrive, then the get is not get, or vice versa, depending what he wants. So there are many conditions. In the days of David HaMelech, all the soldiers wrote a get on time to their wives. If they'll be killed in war, then the get will be retroactively from the day that I signed. Why did I need it? That was because if he's dead, then she's anyway freed. She doesn't need a get. But if they didn't have children, she needs Yibum. And if they wanted to free her from Yibum, then the get would apply from the day that I signed. They wanted to do something similar in Israel when the state came up and there were soldiers, and that was for aguna purposes. If he's being killed in the war and you don't find him, so the woman is an aguna. So they wanted to institute the same tnai that was in the days of David HaMelech for a different purpose. But it wasn't accepted. I won't go into the complications. But in this case, when the signs of dementia are already clear and it's clear what the path is going to be, that could be a good idea.
I'm wondering if this idea of giving a get in advance of incompetence, right, that you're talking about, could be included at least as an option in every halachic prenup agreement.
Yeah, it could. I mean, again, I it's not my field. I don't want to go into all the complications that such conditioning can cause, but there are a lot of problems with it. You need to know how to write it. Every condition, every tnai has to be hen kodem lemaaseh and has to be hen velav. And there are a lot of conditions how to write a condition. That's not a simple matter like we between us say, I'm giving you $100 provided you'll fly to Jerusalem. And if you don't fly, it's your money or whatever. That halachically won't be sufficient. That's not at night. So it is complicated to do it. But I think in such unusual situations, it should be applied.
Okay, hold on. I'll give you the mic. The next person wants to raise their hand and I'll give you the mic and then.
How would halacha view gender dysphoria? Would that be shote ledavar echad?
Well, I don't think that it is a shote. I think it's wrong from different other points of view. But he is competent. He says, I don't feel good with my situation. I want to change the situation. It's not within the regular definitions of a shote. And certainly psychiatrically, at least nowadays, it's not regarded as an illness. It used to be, but it changed by vote, not because science has proven it's right, but there was a vote and now it's okay. It's an alternative lifestyle, but that's a whole other story to discuss. Okay, thank you.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Can everybody hear? Yes? Okay, good. So first of all, I wanted to thank Torah in Motion for giving me this really incredible opportunity. I have very, very, very large shoes to fill, and so I'm going to try my best. What? I'm not a techie. Okay. What? Is that better? Yeah? A little? I don't know. My kids say I talk too much and too loud. I'm not doing it. No slide check. No slide check. Okay. Is this better?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, great. Ready? Okay, great. So again, good morning. Thank you very much to Torah in Motion for this incredible opportunity and for the really unbelievable panel of speakers that are here today that I will try to emulate. So I'm Dr. Debbie Ackerman, and I have a private practice in Northern Jersey, and I'm full-time faculty at Yeshiva University, Wurzweiler School of Social Work. My clinical specialty is addiction, and that's what we're going to talk about today, is addiction and the Orthodox Jewish community. I'd like to say special thank you to my student, Jonathan, who's joined us. He's in my addiction class, and I'm going to let Jonathan do the lecture just to show you how good I am at teaching. Jonathan? No, I'm kidding. Jonathan needs a stiff drink right now. And I do want to say special thank you to my husband, who is unwavering support and really is incredibly helpful and supportive of my process. So thank you. So the objectives of this talk is to understand the concept of addiction, not really from a medical point of view. This is a room full of MDs, and I don't have to tell you about how drugs and alcohol affect the heart, the liver, bloodstream. You all know that. I would like people to walk out of this room having a different concept of the person who has the disease of addiction, a different understanding, a different mindset. I think it's also important that we recognize the connection between the micro and the macro level and how that plays into addiction. And then, of course, how can we implement any type of change within our community? So what is addiction, right? What exactly does it mean? Well, there's a lot of different definitions, which are basically pretty much the same. Addiction is a state of psychological or physical dependence or both, and the use of alcohol or drugs. This comes from the APA Dictionary of Psychology. NIDA and SAMHSA, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration, those are two of the organizations in America that deal with addiction on a national level. Quote, addiction is defined as a chronic relapsing disorder characterized by compulsive drug seeking, continued use despite harmful consequences, and long-lasting changes in the brain. It's considered both a complex brain disorder and a mental illness. Addiction is the most severe form of a full spectrum of substance use disorders, and it is a medical illness caused by repeated misuse of substance or other substances. What I like for people to take out of that definition is that it is chronic and relapsing. Once a person has addiction, they're going to have it for life. And relapse is a part of recovery. Do we want it? No, we don't want it. But like any disease process, there is always a chance of a relapse. And just like in the medical model, we want to see the periods of recovery become longer and longer and longer, and that people should not relapse. But they do, and that is a part of the syndrome. According to some statistics, the National Survey of Drug Behavior said that 19.7 million adults 12 and older had a substance use disorder in 2017. 74% had alcohol use disorder. One out of eight struggled with both alcohol and drugs. 8.5 million individuals had co-occurring disorder. And the cost of addiction in America is $740 billion yearly. We attribute that to lost productivity, healthcare costs, and crime. The Hebrew word for addiction, interestingly, is machur, and that has two definitions. Somebody who was sold or who was bought by somebody, and somebody who's been transferred to the domain of the buyer. Somebody who has a very strong dependence physically or mentally on a particular substance and finds it hard to quit. Well, the addict is sold to the substance and does become enslaved by it. It's a very interesting thing in addiction. 70% of individuals who work in the field of addiction counseling have either had a personal experience or a family member who's had an experience with addiction, and I am no exception to that rule. When I went into social work school in 2008, I had already made up my mind that I wanted to work in addiction. And when I told people that's what I wanted to do, they're like, you're crazy. Okay, no problem. Why do you want to do that? It's depressing. You're a woman. Who's going to want to come to you? You really don't want to do this. Why don't you work in child welfare? You have 11 children. You know children. Do something else. But I had definitely decided and made up my mind that I wanted to work in addiction. In 2009, I went to the Nefesh conference. There was a special rate for students, and I decided to go. My first year going, there was maybe one or two talks on addiction in the entire conference. By the time I went a year later, there were definitely many more talks. And the last year I went, I was graduating, and I was incredibly desperate for a job. So I took a pile of resumes and started to hand them out, like, you know, cards to people. And I was offered a job. The job that I was offered was under an organization, a non-Jewish organization that had partnered with a clinic in one of the Orthodox neighborhoods in the tri-state area. And they wanted to bring an outpatient treatment center to this Orthodox community. And I was hired to start the clinic, bring patients in, and pretty much run it. From the beginning of that job, there was a huge conflict between the people from the outside clinic and the administration from the clinic in the Orthodox Jewish community. The people of the umbrella clinic said that there was enough clients within the patient population within the clinic to definitely put up one or two programs. And that if we just started to teach the clinicians and the administration how to assess for addiction, we would have ourselves a really robust running program. The administration from the Orthodox Jewish clinic said, no, you need to go out, go do outreach, go to the courts, go to the schools, go do anything you can and bring the clients in. The program lasted 6 months, and we could not get 10 people to walk through the door with addiction in a major Jewish community in 2010. And in the words of the great philosopher Karl Popper, you should embrace your mistakes like you do good friends. And this became the impetus for my dissertation work. I was transferred to another clinic that the umbrella agency ran, and I started working in addiction and built my career. At that point, I was enrolled in the doctoral program, and I decided that I was going to write on why there are no outpatient treatment facilities in the Orthodox Jewish community. The title of my dissertation is Build It and They Will Come, The Lack of Outpatient Treatment Centers in the Orthodox Jewish Community. In the huge amounts of research that I did in the dissertation, there's one quote that stood out for me. And this is by David Courtwright, who wrote a book called Dark Paradise, The History of Opiate Addiction in America in 2001. David Courtwright says, quote, what we think about addiction depends on who it is that is addicted. Addiction is a way of thinking, not doing. And in order to treat somebody with addiction, you have to understand what we talk about when we say addictive thinking. Rabbi Dr. Abraham Twersky, who anybody in the field of addiction will credit as the person who absolutely brought addiction to the forefront of our community back in the 1970s when nobody was talking about addiction in the Jewish community. And it is to the late and great Rabbi Dr. Abraham Twersky that I am able to do what I'm able to do and that anybody in this field can do it and that we are now really making some inroads within our community. So he writes in his book, Rabbi Dr. Abraham Twersky, this wonderful little example. There's a gentleman and he likes to drink. He likes to do scotch and water and he's starting to develop some symptoms of an ulcer. And so he says to himself, you know what? It's probably the water, something in the water that's, you know, not doing it for me. So he switches to scotch and seltzer. His symptoms of ulcer are getting worse. He says, it's got to be the seltzer. You know, bubbles, not good for my stomach. It's just not good. So he switches to scotch on the rocks, scotch over ice cubes. And the symptoms of his ulcer continue to get worse. And he says, it's got to be the ice cubes. Cold, it's not good for my stomach. It's the cold. And he switches to straight scotch. Most people laugh. It's absurd. But that is the way somebody with addiction thinks. People say to me all the time, how do you work with people with addiction? They're liars. Of course they're liars. I know my clients are lying to me. I accept that. I don't fight it. Part of the disease of addiction, part of the pathology is minimizing, denying, and lying. And one of the hallmark symptoms of addiction is the denial of the process. Once you can break through the denial, you can start to affect treatment. Step one of the 12-step program says, we admitted we were powerless over whatever it is, alcohol, marijuana, opioids, and our lives had become unmanageable. That is one of the hardest steps for people in recovery to accept. I don't have an addiction. I've had many clients come to me very angrily and say, you know what? Fine, I'm going to show you. I'll get sober for 3 months, and then I'm going to go back to drinking and doing drugs. I'll show you. Go ahead. So is addiction an illness or is it a sin? Even in this day, addiction is the most stigmatized disease out there. How do we describe people with addiction? Think of how they're called. Crackhead, meth head, junkie, stoner. We have our own version. Oh, he's just a shicker. There has never been one complimentary or neutral word. And my students, Jonathan, you better back me up, are taught to say the individual has the disease of addiction. They're not an addict. That is not what they are. They are a human being that has the disease of addiction. And they are to be afforded the respect and the dignity of any other human being. There's a very interesting history of addiction that people either don't know or tend to ignore. In the 1930s, there was a physician named Dr. Silkworth, and he worked or operated a hospital called the Charles B. Towns Hospital in New York City. And it was kind of like a rehab. People with alcoholism would come in, kind of dry out, get better, go back out, drink again, come back in, and go out. And it costs money. It was kind of like a high-end rehab for the 1930s. And he likened alcoholism to, quote, an obsession of the mind that condemned one to drink and an allergy to the body that condemned one to die. So Dr. Silkworth likened it to an allergy. The person with alcoholism, their bodies simply could not metabolize like other people when alcohol hit their system. We know this today to be true. And Dr. Alan Leshner likened addiction to, quote, a switch in the brain, that when the brain gets that desired substance or behavior, a switch flips up, and then it is nearly impossible to turn off the circuitry. What do people in our religion think about addiction? Well, if you look in the Bible, if you look in the Torah, you see that Noah was the first person to get drunk. And I think many of us know it didn't end particularly well for him either, what we call his bottom, which also wasn't great. But it's an interesting thing because we do endorse the use of wine. We are a religion that heavily uses wine every Friday night for Kiddush, for a bris, for a chasana. We have no problem. There are some shuls, I am told, that have something called a Kiddush club. I've never been, but apparently it is something that is popular. There are psychologists and rabbis out there that will tell you that addiction is used to fill a spiritual void in the individual. That individual is empty, they have no meaning, they have no purpose, and so they use the drugs or the behavior to fill that void. But why? Why are there so many people out there that don't have meaning? Why are our numbers so staggering that people need to use this behavior or substance to fill a void? Those of us who work in addiction counseling know the answer. There is a very, very strong correlation, almost one-to-one, between childhood trauma and addiction. Anecdotally, at this point, I kind of make my clients prove to me that they have not had trauma. And in all my years of working in addiction, I have met maybe two people who became addicted that didn't have a history of significant childhood trauma. Back in the 1980s, a physician named Dr. Vincent Folletti, who was working for Kaiser Permanente,
He was in charge of their preventative medicine clinic and ran an obesity clinic. And people came to him who were 200, 300, 400, 500 pounds overweight. And they were really in danger of dying. And being that morbidly obese is also an incredibly physically uncomfortable way to live. And very, very stigmatized and judged. You can't travel. Let us not even talk about airline seats, but you really are kind of bound because society will not accommodate for you. So he put his patients on a high protein, calorie restricted diet, and people started to lose weight, a lot of weight, 100 pounds, 200 pounds, 300 pounds. That's pretty good. But then they started to gain it back, and he didn't understand what was happening. And this repeated itself. And one day he was working with one of the patients and he said, what's going on? She had lost 300 pounds. She gained back 37 immediately and then started to gain all the weight back in a short amount of time that it took her to lose the weight. And she told Dr. Folletti that she lost all this weight and she was at work and one of her coworkers said something to her like, you look really good, and started to kind of flirt with her. And she started to gain all the weight back. When Dr. Folletti began to talk to her, she disclosed that she had been molested by her father in her youth. Dr. Folletti very correctly put the two and two together and started to have his team talk to clients and patients about their background. He didn't yell at them. He didn't shame them. He didn't talk about cholesterol or heart disease or cancer or liver problems. He simply started to talk to his patients and he found an unbelievably large proportion of them had had childhood trauma. Through this, Dr. Folletti created what he called the ACEs scale or the ACEs study. And ACEs stands for Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. It was a 10-year longitudinal study, and he found that the higher you scored on the ACEs scale, the higher your adverse childhood experience, which could be poverty, living with a parent with mental illness, living with a parent with addiction, witnessing violence, having a parent be incarcerated, raised your ACEs score, and that as an adult, you would be much more susceptible to a chronic medical condition, heart disease, diabetes, cancer, and addiction. Those of us who work in the addiction field know 1 out of 4 children will have an unwanted sexual touch before they reach the age of 18. 90% of them will be from someone that they know, a family member, relative, a trusted individual. Individuals who have the illness of molesting children go through an elaborate process of grooming. And the first thing they do is groom the parents. They make sure that they are an entrusted individual that the parents can trust, a teacher, an uncle, a grandfather, and then they begin their grooming process for the children. Children who are molested, because of the way children's brains develop, they are very egocentric. The world truly revolves around them. They don't get the part in the play. Their life is over. You don't buy them the latest whatever. Life is not worth living. And we need this. Children need that egocentrism to develop normally. Egocentrism does not work well when you have been abused because then it gets turned inward and children blame themselves. They must have done something wrong in order to be treated that way. And because children are so dependent on us, we are the only creature in the world that keeps our children as close to us as we do for that many years. They are dependent on us for everything, food, shelter, love, and emotional sustenance. And they have zero ability to understand that it is the adults in their lives that have the sickness. And the amounts of shame and guilt that they carry will last them a lifetime and definitely contribute 100% to their addictive process. David Palkovitz gave a talk once on childhood molestation, and his bottom line and point that he said is if a child comes to you and tells you that they have been molested, You have about 2 minutes to change the trajectory of their lives. Anything other than, I believe you, it is not your fault, and we will do anything and everything we can to help you get better. We'll put the child over into a different realm. There's very interesting research coming out lately, linking addiction to what we call the para-aqueductal gray matter. In a study that came out of Brigham Young University, they are finding links between addiction and the para-aqueductal gray. We know that the PAG, the para-aqueductal gray, is involved as an integration and execution of both active and passive self-protective behaviors against an imminent threat, what we know as fight or flight. The PAG activity is also associated integrating responses against physical discomfort, like anxiety, fear, pain, and disgust. These feelings are present before the threat emerges, but these feelings are also there from the withdrawal from drugs like morphine and cocaine. And it is well documented that the PAG is connected to many other nuclei in the brain. Preclinical models suggest that the PAG contributes to the modulation of anxiety, fear, and nociception, which may produce physical discomfort that is linked with chronic exposure to drugs of abuse. And in their review, they discuss the PAG as, quote, an integrator of responses to the physical discomfort associated with drug withdrawal. Therefore, there is a very strong neural connection between addiction and the para-aqueductal gray. But there's more research that's going on. There has been lots of research done to find the neurological base of spirituality. And we know that people can experience this type of oneness and have a greater or higher purpose. Albert Einstein, for example, reported this feeling when he would have an epiphany. Spirituality is similar to love, and it has physiological effects in the body. And we are now finding that there is definitely a physical and neurobiological place for spirituality. In 2021, a study by Ferguson et al., which was published in the journal Biological Psychiatry, tried to find the brain circuit associated with spirituality, a feeling of being connected to something larger than oneself, which is how we define spirituality. And Dr. Ferguson says, quote, our results suggest that spirituality and religiosity are rooted in fundamental neurobiological dynamics and deeply woven into our neurofabric. This study used neuro-lesion network mapping, and they found that both positive and negative nodes in the PAG circuit, in other words, a person's spiritual beliefs either increased or decreased, depending on which node was interrupted by the brain lesion. As we know that the PAG has been associated with a wide range of functions, fear conditioning, pain modulation, altruistic behaviors, and unconditional love, all of which are tied to what we previously discussed with the PAG as an addiction center. And as I was reading this research, I started to formulate an idea of my own. If the PAG modulates the fear response and it modulates the spiritual response, and trauma definitely affects a person's spirituality, and trauma and addiction are linked, then this is where the beginning of the spiritual disease starts. In order to understand spirituality and what it has to do with addiction in our community, we have to kind of figure out what it is. And there is a very major difference between spirituality and religion. Religion is a set of rules and laws that anybody who follows the religion is going to follow. We have Hashem, and we believe that Hashem brought down those laws, and we follow them through what Moshe, Rabbeinu, and everybody has taught us, and this is how we live our life. Religion is also communal. Interestingly, ChatGPT is becoming, you know, kind of the rage, and I was talking about it with my husband, and I said, how am I going to know if my students wrote their own papers? I don't really like this. So we put in a prompt from one of my classes into the ChatGPT, and it turned out a really good, like, two-page paper. I'm like, God, this is horrible. Like, how am I going to know this? So my husband, being the scientist, like, let's put something else in. So we put the title of my dissertation in. I told you before that my dissertation is about building outpatient clinics Well, ChatGPT said my dissertation is about creating a new religion. So you better all give me a lot of respect because I'm about to create a new religion. Right? And that my dissertation studied what infrastructure I would need in order to create this new religion. Right? It doesn't, well, whatever. So religion is communal. Religion involves community. There are no individual people who do religion except for me, because that's what ChatGPT said I'm going to do. Spirituality is individual. Everybody has their own definition of spirituality or what elevates them. To be spiritual is to find something higher than yourself, to find something that means more than something else. And that can be anything. That could be a babbling brook. It could be art. It could be music. It could be nature. Anything that puts you in a place of a higher element is spirituality. And we really can't question people's spirituality. It is what it is. I'm fortunate to teach the spirituality course in Yeshiva University in the School of Social Work, and it's a required course. So why do we need spirituality in social work? And one of the most important articles that we do is called Our Clients, Ourselves, The Spiritual Perspective of Social Work Practice by Dr. Pat Sermabikian in March 1994. I know Dr. Sermabikian. She's a phenomenal woman, fantastic practitioner, and an incredibly spiritual person. So why do we need spirituality, especially in my line of work? Well, I don't know about other practitioners, but nobody ever makes an appointment to see me and sits down and says, look, I just wanted to come here and tell you my life is amazing. It's amazing, right? My house is paid off. We bought another house. We're going on this great cruise. One of my sons got into Brisk. Another one got into Harvard. And oh my God, look at the bracelet my husband just got me. I mean, life is just amazing. I have yet to have a client walk through the door and tell me that. Social workers, and I do put a plug in for our profession, we see people at their most desperate times. Working in the field of addiction, I see people who are about to have major legal consequences, have health consequences, are financially devastated, have children out there that they just found out about and that their partners do not know. And life can be really rough. I have often said that faith is great when things are good. And you could always see people saying, Baruch Hashem, things are great. And Baruch Hashem, my son did this. And Baruch Hashem, everything is amazing. What happens when it's not so good? And that is where the spirituality comes in. We need to help people find that meaning. We need to take people through that journey of healing, which includes getting angry, which includes processing all of those emotions that they were not allowed to process when they were younger, and hopefully which results in forgiveness and healing. Spirituality work is not linear work. In order to do spirituality work, you have to completely revamp your thinking. Carl Jung broke with Sigmund Freud over the notion of spirituality. Sigmund Freud, in a nutshell, was all about being angry, wanting sex, and brooding over death. And Carl Jung said, no, there's got to be another something to people. We have got to have a spiritual side to us, something that puts us away from all those physical thoughts. And it takes a way of thinking that takes away from pathologizing individuals, from pathologizing mental illness. Our clients are not people that are just symptoms. Social work is a holistic viewpoint of individuals, and we work very, very hard, and everybody has it, to find their point of strength, the point that they can start to feel good about themselves, and work towards becoming a more full, complete, and happy human being. Part of my dissertation work, I started to think, why does our community have such a difficulty with addiction? I just didn't understand it, honestly. We are a community that is steeped in chesed. What's going on? Well, if you had to explain Judaism on one foot, Many people say, well, you should love your neighbor as yourself. That's kind of where we're at. And that's true. But I also thought that it's a very important part of our religion and our culture and our tradition that we take anything physical and we elevate it to the point of spiritual. I teach this to my class, and the students who know it, the Orthodox students know, but the non-Jewish students kind of look at me. We wake up in the morning. First thing, we say, Moda Ani, thank you, God, for giving us a day. Then we wash our hands. Then we get dressed. Right shoe on, left shoe on, tie the left shoe, tie the right shoe. Then you go and daven. Then you sit down for breakfast. You eat your food in a particular order. If you wash, great, you covered it. If not, there's an order in which you have to do things, and so on and so forth. We move through our day, through our week, through our years, through our lives, taking every single thing physical and elevating it to the point of spiritual. I may be wrong on this, but I think we're the only religion that has a blessing after going to the bathroom, which is really a good thing and really just shows us how we know that every physical thing we are given is a gift and we need to thank Hashem for it. This concept of the physical and the spiritual has been around for a very long time, and it is represented in many different thoughts in our religion. One of the most famous ones is Rabbi Soloveitchik's Lonely Man of Faith, which was composed in 1965. And in Lonely Man of Faith, Rabbi Soloveitchik discusses Sefer Bereishis and what he calls Adam 1 and Adam 2. The first version of Adam, Rabbi Soloveitchik says, and he said it's brought down a lot, is Hashem created Adam in his image, created him with Chava, with a partner, and he was told that he would have dominion over the whole world. Take it, create it, build it, do it. That's your Adam 1. In Perek Beis, he talks about Adam as being nothing but a dust ball. It's like a lump of clay. And Hashem had to breathe life into this lump of clay in order for it to be. Once he breathed life into Adam, he was alone. He did not have a partner. And he was put into the garden and he was told to work it and to guard it. There's no dominion there. You are responsible. Hashem saw that he was lonely, but then he had to be put into a deep sleep and literally take his rib, take a piece out of his body in order to create his partner. So which one is it Rabbi Soloveitchik talks about? Are we all omnipotent, made in the image of God, or are we a dust ball? How do we weave through that? Rabbi Soloveitchik goes further and says that Adam 1 asks one question. How? How do we do this? How do I make it bigger? How do I make it better? How do I make more money? How do I invent? How do I do things? I don't know about you, but I think Elon Musk wants us to start vacationing on Mars. I barely made it through an hour flight here to Toronto, so I don't think that's going to be my wheelhouse. But if you guys want to go, send me pictures. How? Adam 2 asks another question. Why? Why are we here? What is the purpose of our being here? What are we doing? And according to Rabbi Soloveitchik and many other thoughts in our religion, this is the conflict from the minute we are born. And hopefully, Rabbi Dr. Avram Sternberg, we should live a really long life without dementia or any horrible things till 120. Just amen. Thank you. Yeah. And this is what we have to weave. There is a very wonderful TED Talk that I encourage all of you to listen to by David Brooks, who's a journalist for the New York Times. And he calls his TED Talk Resume Virtues versus Eulogy Virtues. And in it, he describes how we are all striving for those resume virtues, things that make us look good to other people and that give us money. Input leads to output and risk leads to reward. But David Brooks says we should really be working on our eulogy virtues. How do you want to be remembered? How do you want to be known? But he says that we don't value Adam 2. And he bases his talk on Rabbi Soloveitchik's Adam 1 and Adam 2 and Lonely Man of Faith. He states that our society values Adam 1, and that turns you into a shrewd animal, who is only interested in getting ahead in this world. There is the lore of the great Rebbe who wore golden slippers with jewels and gold threads, but the bottoms were bare so that every place he walked, he felt the stones and the thorns and the pain. And here is where I believe our community has an issue with addiction. For people that don't understand addiction, it looks like a taiva. You're simply a bal taiva. You can't stop drinking. You can't stop eating. If you come to my next talk, you can't stop having sex. And we judge that because we are above that. And we are dignified people who take physical things and make them spiritual. And I believe that that is a huge reason that our community has a very difficult time facing people with addiction. It's a sin. Just get over it. When we speak about Jews, mental health, and in America, Jews are not only a minority, 2.5% of the American population, and we are a third of 1% of the world population. And although America is 83% white, it is 95% Christian. So being Jewish in America is more uncommon than being non-white. So we need to take our personal understanding of stigma and our personal community's way of living in order to work effectively with the person or people with the disease of addiction. According to Castro, 1998, writing for SAMHSA, culture is defined as, one, a common heritage and history that's passed from generation to generation. Number two, shared values, beliefs, customs, behaviors, traditions, institutions, arts, folklore, and lifestyle. Number three, a similar relationship and socialization pattern. Number four, a common pattern of style of communication and language. Number five, geographic location of the residents and similar ways of dress and diet. Each community operates pretty much the same, but with a lot of differences. I remember a couple that I worked with, a Hasidic couple that was going away for Pesach, and they spent the entire hour of the session arguing over what shade of gray shoe their son should wear, because the woman was terrified if she showed up with the wrong shade of shoe, her mother was going to just be incredibly angry with her. Our community suffers from an enormous amount of stigma. Even that example I just gave of showing up with the wrong shoe would create horrible stigma for this woman. So what is stigma? Stigma is defined as a combination of inaccurate or distorted beliefs, negative attitudes, and discriminatory behaviors, which include stereotyping and separating us from them. There are several types of stigma. Internalized stigma is directed at the affected individual. Social stigma is felt in everyday interactions with family, friends, and the wider community. Structural stigma is a prejudice that's found in our society systems, like the legal system, the business system, media. Stigma does not only harm the person that has mental illness or substance abuse, but also their families. And this is what is known as courtesy stigma, which is extremely important in our community when people are very, very concerned with getting their children married off into the right families. Stigma is the reason that people in our community delay treatment. The constant fear of being rejected if the diagnosis of addiction comes out. And according to Corrigan in 2006, family stigma varied by role. Mothers reported tremendous fear for being blamed for causing their child's condition through bad parenting. Siblings and spouses were blamed if the individual didn't manage their illness or adhere to the treatment. And the children of those with mental illness were viewed as contaminated. I'm working with a young girl now who I have to honestly say gets the gold medal for the amount of trauma she's endured. I'm not sure she wanted that prize, but she pretty much gets it. She was raised in abject poverty, an incredibly large family, and she slept by the doorway on the floor. I don't even think she had a mat. Her mother is absolutely mentally ill, and her father has the cognition, I think, of a seven-year-old. This girl has been repeatedly molested by family members since she was about 5 years old. And she has addiction. I think she definitely has a disease of addiction and alcoholism. And she has a disease of addiction in that she has become a sex and love addict. This girl is incredibly compelling. Incredibly. You see her addictive thinking in very many ways. And the other night she called me. She was babysitting. And while she was babysitting, she drank a half a bottle of vodka in about a half an hour. I said, well, what's with the kids? She said, they're sleeping. I said, okay. And then she started to panic. She's like, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? They're going to find the vodka. What am I going to do? I'm going to fill it with water. And she was on the phone with me and she took the bottle to the sink and filled it with water. And then she was like, oh no, it's overflowing. It's all water. It's not vodka. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? So just take it easy. Call me when the mother gets home. Let me know everything is okay. She started texting me. Thank you so much. I love you. You're the only person who cares. I'm working very hard to keep this girl in our community. All of her siblings do not live at home. Every one of them has been placed with another family. We found her a really wonderful family to live with this year. And she has 1 year left of high school. I am working extremely hard to keep her in high school. I don't want her to have another loss. Quite frankly, I don't care if she flunks. I just want her to be able to achieve a goal and not be thrown out. I've had a lot of interesting interactions with the Hanhala, who talked to me about her tsnias, who talked to me about her hefkeris and how out of control she is, and that is not becoming of a Beis Yaakov girl. I tell the school that this is trauma, and she is a highly dysregulated girl, and we are working with her. We have a psychiatrist helping her now. I have attempted to get her into a 12-step program and a support group for adolescents that have addiction issues. But it's a constant battle between me and the system. My study question for my dissertation was why we don't have any outpatient treatment centers. And the variables that I looked for were denial, stigma, and knowledge of what addiction was. I ended up with a 43.6% participation rate, and I surveyed directors of mental health clinics around the tri-state area. Out of the responses, 75% of the administrators of these clinics said that their clinicians not only didn't know how to treat addiction, but had no idea how to assess for it. And I find that to be problematic. You don't have to treat addiction if you don't want to. But with the numbers in our community, you most certainly should know how to assess for it and then refer to the appropriate treatment. Very, very, very proud of one of my students from last semester who, after our class, advocated for one of her clients who they said was borderline and needed DBT. And she said, no, he has addiction, and started to list the criteria. And she fought a really good battle for him, and they ended up putting him in a 12-step program, and he did better. What do we need to do? Well, we have definitely made some great strides. I also want to end on a positive note, not the one that we should not get dementia. Sorry. Or any other illness. Nefesh and conferences are now addressing addiction. There are organizations that are coming up all over, some of which I'm a part of, that are working to educate communities on what addiction is. I work for MASC, Mothers and Fathers Aligned Against Saving Children. I run a weekly support group for parents that have children, adolescent children, adult children that have either mental illness, addiction, or both. MASC, which started by Ruchama Klatman, she runs four groups a week, and we are always full. people arrive in great pain, and through the support that they get through the groups are starting to move towards recovery. But here's what we really need to do. When you point two fingers at someone, three come back at you. So we need to look at ourselves. We need to ask ourselves, why are we so uncomfortable? Why can't we talk about children being molested? Why can't we talk about what's happening in our community with alcohol, drug, and sex addiction? Our community still has a tremendous amount of under-reporting. We really have no idea what the numbers are. And one of the limitations of my study was that there was simply not enough literature for a literature review. Now there's more, but I spent the better part of about a year and a half just trying to gather data, and there was none. It's time for us to get together and have meaningful, constructive dialogue. It's time for us to stop shaming people. It's time for us to start to embrace individuals and their families and our community who have the disease of addiction in their home. It is time for us to start to get comfortable with a 12-step program created in 1935 by two very ill alcoholics, Bill and Bob. It is a worldwide free peer facilitated program that addresses the thinking of the addict and is very successful. It is time for us to start to eliminate kiddish clubs, because children who see their parents being lauded for a $500 bottle of scotch are going to have a really strong pull towards a $500 bottle of scotch. It is time for us as a community to abandon drinking on Purim and on Simchas Torah. Binge drinking, which is four or more drinks for a man in under 2 hours and five or more drinks for a woman in under 2 hours, is the number one form of drinking that sends people to the hospital every year. Coming here today and listening is part of the solution. And I do want to thank all of you for coming and participating. Please spread the word. People with addiction, the disease of addiction, are the most wonderful people who struggle every single day with demons that none of you want to know about. And they're trying. Punishing them, yelling at them, ostracizing them is not going to work. The United States has a long history of incarcerating and punishing people with addiction, and it doesn't work. And in the vein of spirituality, it is an inverse proportion. They need to be bathed with love and understanding and compassion. And one day at a time, which is a slogan from the 12-step program, I do believe we can get there. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. I'm Michelle Friedman, and I'm just recovering from a cold. And we're also 15 minutes into the discussion period. And this session is supposed to end at 11. And I know that there are many people in this room who have firsthand experience with the topics that have been discussed thus far. And I am a huge believer in, if people are familiar with, open space dialogue and interaction. So I really want there to be Q&A and discussion. So I am going to shorten my presentation to moments, really like maybe 5 to 10 minutes or something like that, because it's just too valuable to not have the wisdom of the people and the shared experience, which is one of the things that I really want to pitch. I'm a huge believer in peer support, which of course is one of the tenets of 12-step programs, is you learn from each other. Now, just one moment about me, because you're going to be hearing me a bunch of times over this weekend. So I am a psychiatrist in private practice, and this is actually the end of my 41st year of private practice, which has given me the tremendous privilege of having seen people who've struggled with different kinds of addictions for a very long time. So having the longitudinal experience is very profound, because you get to know people's lives, the interaction of their families, et cetera, their spiritual lives, as Debbie was just talking about. But the other part of what I do, in addition to private practice, is I've had the privilege of almost 25 years now of creating a program for rabbis as first responders, teaching rabbis how to be aware, how to close, listen to, as I say, you have two ears and one mouth. Close, you know, hold on to your anxiety. Learn to listen to what people are bringing to you. Rabbis, mechanchim, are first responders. And I'm a huge believer in teaching first responders, who people come to, how to be tuned in to these kinds and many other kinds of issues. So I'm bringing to you some of my experience from years in the field of teaching rabbis and working with panels of rabbis, people coming, doing like peer supervision of what people in the community are dealing with in terms of addictions. So, okay, so I'm really working on like this is like a zip file of what, yeah.
Half an hour between the end of the session,
right,
and the beginning of the next.
People can, right, but I know how that goes, and like I know that one, people need to have some air time. I mean, there's a lot long time in a closed room with no windows, so I don't want to, like, I get that too. So and Debbie said a tremendous amount about the what goes into addiction, and my task, I was given the job of talking about exploring the recovery process, but of course you can't talk about recovery unless you understand causation, vulnerability, which Debbie talked about, the high incidence of trauma in this community, and of course, a certain genetic vulnerability. Because one of the big whys in this world is, you know, unfortunately, a staggering number of people are exposed to different kinds of trauma, like, as Debbie mentioned, sexual abuse, you know, 1 in 4. But not every person becomes addicted to a substance or a behavior. Why is it? And why do people gravitate to, I mean, there are people who have multiple addictions, but there are people for whom they don't care about weed, they only want to drink. There are people who really are internet, you know, electronic addicts and don't use substances. And that's really a fascinating, probably biologic thing. So I just want to expand in talking about prevention that I'm not going to go into the specifics of this, obviously not in a few minutes, but I want to just you to keep in mind three categories, basically, of addiction. Substances, which is what most of us tend to think about, like alcohol, street drugs, and certainly prescription drugs. Now there's a huge thing of psychedelics, which doesn't have so much addictive, like you need to go back and use it and use it, but it is absolutely mushrooming, the use of psychedelics. And I would say, that's a good one, right? I didn't even get it myself. And it's stunning to me. In the Hasidic community, there is an explosion of psychedelic tripping. Behaviors, gambling, pornography, sex, which Debbie's going to be talking about later today. And we must include electronics and the internet. And I mean, how many people, how much money would I have? Like, I can't believe I get paid to tell people, when you have dinner with your family, put your cell phone on a shelf. Don't bring your cell phone into the bedroom. Have, you know, I don't know, zones. Like, can you consolidate your whatever checking time, your, you know, whatever it is, TikTok or whatever the thing too, it's mostly Twitter for adults. Can you make it 10 minutes every 2 hours? Can you set a timer? I mean, it's shocking how people really smart, much smarter than me, people need help structuring that kind of stuff. So we're really thinking about all of these aspects when we're thinking about recovery of addiction. Now, what most of us are thinking about with recovery programs are the much more pernicious and devastating and destructive types of addictions, like substances. Now, I was going to do a whole thing on kind of overall points. Debbie covered a lot of them. I'm going to go really pretty directly into the role of Jewish leadership and kind of specific practical kinds of things. I just want to emphasize again the prevalence of addiction, underlying the spiritual, emotional needs that are like what's going on there, how people do hide out for years, how like, and I just want to name that there's the abstinence model, which is much more the 12-step model. I mean, there is some there's movement within that or whatever, versus or in addition to the substitution model, like using methadone or buprenorphine, preventive types of things, and harm reduction. Can you drink a little? Can you smoke a little weed? Like these are big topics, which I'm certainly not going to answer, but I just want to put it out there. Another big thing I think is important to keep in mind is differentiating sobriety, achieving immediate sobriety, I mean, from recovery. So somebody, and Debbie did mention this, like, okay, yeah, you can do a 30-day, 28-day, whatever the insurance program covers, but what happens when you get back into the world and everything's available? And this is true not only with substances, definitely with food. You know, how many of us have seen people have had bariatric surgery and managed to overcome, Debbie was talking about diet, but people have had their stomachs, you know, surgically changed and then override that because their need for that kind of satiation and you know, feeding, whatever that feeding is all about, will override the surgery and they will gain back that 150 pounds. So what does that mean in terms of recovery and prevention? Okay, I'm going to go right into the role of Jewish leadership, because really just, I mean, Debbie and I did talk about over the phone our what we were going to cover, but we didn't go into like the nitty gritty of the notes, but I'm going to just build on that. I want to emphasize what she said about religion and spirituality, because these are huge powers, which I tell my students all the time. There are many differences between mental health professionals, similarities also, and rabbis, and clergy in general. But one of the big ones is that rabbis are seen by lay community as having special power, special agency, representing the Masorah, have so many people a hotline to God, and use that, work both aspects of it. One being the power of religious community, you know, the whole hierarchy, the rules, the regulations, even the stigma, because every socialized religion or community does depend. We have to just put this in also to a certain degree on social stigma to keep people in line. And that is a very fascinating and difficult topic. Like, when is stigma sort of a good thing because we don't want Yenim to know we got to behave? But, and when does it become terrible? And when does it shame us and make us feel bad? And how can rabbis and educators harness the power of community practice, religious ritual, etc., and also the power of spirituality? Yes, spirituality is an individual experience, but if rabbis and educators aren't touching on what are we here for, what means something to us, you know, then they're not doing their jobs, and it's becoming, you know, it just becomes kind of rote. So, okay, so now I'm going to talk about, I think, the power of the shul rabbi. And Debbie mentioned Parshas Noach. Okay, that's like the classic. But I believe that if you're thinking, if you care about addiction of any kind, you can give a drasha on addiction any time of year, not just Vayikra, not just Parshas Noach. You can find, it's like when you have, I'm always telling my students, think when you're listening to a congregant, think creatively. Think of the most wild explanation that could be going on. Make up stories and be creative, because a lot of it's going to be wrong. Don't get too attached to your stories. But if you don't think of something, you're not going to find the material that's going to either substantiate or refute your hypothesis. So similarly, if a rabbi cares about addiction of any form, that rabbi can find a place, that educator can find a place in the syllabus, in the year, whatever, to hang a drasha on. And that is a very, very powerful place, because once somebody speaks about something openly, it's become part of the community. It's something we talk about. So increasing mindfulness in general is incredibly important. And listening to people, learning how to listen, and listening to people's hesitancies instead of just pushing kinds of things. Like, for example, Debbie mentioned, and we must come back to this, the whole Kiddush Club thing. This is like, you know, there's such a wink, wink, nod, nod attitude towards Kiddush Clubs. Like, how many times have you heard people say, oh, you know, Kiddush Clubs, it's really fun, whatever. But there's really serious issues of people getting absolutely blasted at kiddush club, sleeping through the afternoon or being abusive in the afternoon. And the sense of power and, kind of status of the single malt scotches and the different bottles and blah, blah, blah. And the kids coming in and the teenagers getting a shot and all that kind of thing is a huge issue. Purim, of course, is an obvious issue, but so are smachot. Like, do you have a vodka waterfall or a scotch bar or whatever, at your simcha? Similarly with food. You know, everybody's always talking about diet, 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 but then you go and, we thought like post-COVID, is there going to be, maybe some degree of modesty since we've had such smaller smachot and all this kind of stuff. I don't actually see that. By the way, I do want to, like Jay mentioned this earlier, the amount of addictions during COVID was like crazy. This one woman that I've been treating for actually about 25 years now joined I'm sure it's all over the world, the Sober Mom Squad, which was kind of a fancier AA for like upper class ladies, who were like knocking back a lot of white wine in those long COVID afternoons. So I can't say enough about the rabbinic attitude towards liquor. Something as simple as always having grape juice. Like if you don't have grape juice for people to make kiddush on, it's like, well, why isn't this person drinking? He's not pregnant, I don't think. I think that just having grape juice available and it gives a message. And the rabbi saying publicly, I'm always going to have grape juice so that people who don't drink will have grape juice. I think another incredibly mindfulness in general is critical. How about Bikur Cholim? How often do people go and visit folks who are in the hospital for addiction treatment, for mental illness in general? That's really a critical thing. Like that should be on the radar of every community rabbi, Bikur Cholim for people who are in treatment. Another thing, and I really want to say like with extreme caution about this, because you have to ask, like when does a Misha Berach, for somebody who is struggling with addiction. Now, obviously, if you make a Misha Berach, somebody's going to say, oh, what's the matter with Moshe? What's the matter with Sonny? So you've got to check it out with the family. Like, never make a Misha Berach if you know somebody's struggling without asking the person if they want it or their family or whatever. But I think that all of these different aspects of specific practice help bring a mindfulness and an awareness into rabbinic work. Creating communal opportunities, having a Yom Iyun on any of these topics. And I can't tell you how many times high schools, usually it's girls' high schools, will say, well, can you come and do a Yom Iyun on eating disorders? And I say, or for parents, like what parent is going to show up at a program for eating disorders? It's like, I may as well just wear a sign. My daughter has anorexia. You can't do that. You've got to create positive type programs like healthy body or whatever, stuff like that. But creating Yemei Iyunim that have that, and this is obviously true about mental illness in general, but we're talking today about addiction and recovery. And I think that bringing this in, and this is really building on what Debbie is talking about, is seeing this not as some like, oh my God, this is a horrible, corrupt person. Yes, recognizing that people with this disease, and which people definitely think is taiva, may do terrible things. And in no way are we copying a blast, exonerating them. They can't cop a plea. I'm a diseased person, I'm an addict, so therefore I get to do XYZ horrible thing. No, that's not it. That's one of the hardest things, by the way, that I find with young rabbis, is when I say, listen, actively, they can recite this by heart. Active, compassionate, non-judgmental listening does not equal, I draw it out always, it's okay. Listening doesn't mean it's okay. Listening means that you were created B'Tselem Elohim, and you may have done really bad stuff, but there's a place for you, and I'm going to try to help you get there in some kind of safe way, or at least listen to you. So I think that in shul events, like it wouldn't be such a terrible thing to have a basket to collect cell phones so people could have like a cell phone free shiur or something like that. And for the rabbi to be speaking about, like, how about everybody try one dinner this week with everybody's cell phone on the shelf? I mean, rabbis have an enormous amount of potential power. And I actually think that rabbis have more power the more they do with it in a way that brings people in a respectful manner. Okay, I'm going to jump to schools. And, you know, a lot of what I just said would apply to, you know, educators and principals and people who are leading youth organizations. But one thing I do want to talk about also in terms of addiction, and Debbie is going to be talking about sex addiction later, is that this is like probably the most scary taboo thing for people. Like, wow, sex addict in community, we must put this person, you know, like so far from the machaneh, they just can't do anything. What do we do? How do we create parameters for people who are convicted of sexual abuse? Now, if you think that rabbis and educators don't know much about addiction, they know less about sex abuse and what you do with people. And I'm privileged, actually, my, you know, the slide that I had to do with, like, you know, my outside organizations, which are none, of course, profit. But I'm very proud to be on the board of Sacred Spaces. And I really encourage everybody to look up Sacred Spaces because it's a Jewish organization that is about Jewish organizations developing safe principles, policies and guidelines for safety for children. And other people who are, and we're working actually on elder policies now as well to help people be safe. So, you know, can a teacher drive a student home? What do you do if you see something that's sort of funky behavior? Can people sit on somebody else's, the candy man's lap? I mean, these are the small questions, but what do you do when a sex offender comes back to a community? One of the most searing experiences I had was going to the Avenel prison in New Jersey, 600 sex offenders under one roof. And we went there to talk to three guys. One was a clergyman and two high school teachers to find out how they would get around the policies that we were trying to develop, because these people are very smart and very wily. And they were in prison for decades, and they were like looking to help us. I mean, they weren't, whatever, that was sort of the philosophy of their program. But we said, when you get out, do you want people in, when they were Christian, do you want people in your church to know that you are, you know, your history, or do you want them not to know? I thought, of course, they're going to say they don't want them to know because they're going to be so stigmatized. But they said, no, the more people who know, the safer we are. Now, okay, that's one point of view, but you got to be thinking about this, because people do get out of prison, or they do get out of whatever program they are, and they come back to community and they're yidden, and they might be the only Kohen, actually. That question has been asked of me, that the only Kohen who came on time had a allegation pending against him. So that was like a tricky question for a small community. And this does not happen infrequently. So I think that when it comes to the educational system, very many similar things. Being real with kids. First of all, kids always know when you're not being real with them, and using proper language, accurate names of body parts, talking about drugs and alcohol that's out there, because it's out there in every single community. Now, it may be a little more accessible on the Upper East Side of Manhattan than it is in New Square, but guess what? It's accessible in New Square also. And all kids need programs that help them acknowledge the availability, the choices, and bystander awareness. What do you do when you see something going on with a friend? What do you see when your friend is binge drinking and getting sick? What do you see, you know, about getting in a car? Somebody says, well, you just, you know, I don't know, whatever it happens to be. So also, the more, this is when rabbis and educators talk about stuff in public, when the educator, and no educator can do this without getting buy-in from the parents. I mean, this is like, you know, this gets explosive with the touchy topics of all kinds of things that educators now have to deal with. Of course, they need to work with the parent body first and the board and all of this. But the more that the rabbis talk and educators talk about this, these topics openly with proper sneers, and they're letting their students know that they're familiar. You see, so it's not just the education that the kids are getting. It's the conveying that I'm familiar with this topic. You can come to me. I'm not going to be freaked out. It's not like I've never heard this before. It's not like, I'm going to be blasted off the face of the universe and you're going to want, you know, feel like you want to drop into some crevice. No, this is part of the human condition. And, you know, we can handle it. I think that just ending with talking about preparation of students, kids leave schools Guess what? Kids graduate from high school. They leave for, many leave for a year in Israel. Many are going to go on to college. They're going to be, this is the whole preparation for a greater degree of independence and selection of choices is a critical task for schools. So in terms of prevention and recovery, and prevention go together. And I think that the role of our Jewish professionals, our clergy, our rabbis, our educators is enormous in this. Okay, so now we could have 15 minutes of Q&A or discussion, and then people could still have like a 5 or 10 minute break. So maybe we should, the three of us should come up here so we can just respond, you know, together. Any questions? Like, yeah, right, fine. So thoughts, questions, responses? About any of this. I mean, I think obviously our addiction material kind of goes together more, but I'm sure Rabbi Steinberg, you might have, people might want to ask a lot of questions about addiction, et cetera, also. So maybe we can just kind of wing it as a group. Please.
Ari, you want to ask? Yeah. I have a question.
I've got two short questions. One is, what area of the brain you were talking about where you found the neuromodulating center of addiction? You said PGA or something.
It's called the PAG, the paraductal gray.
Okay.
Don't ask me anything else. I'm not a neurologist.
The other question is, in the realm of psychotherapy, like the idea of spiritual psychotherapy, is that something that's considered a valid form of psychotherapy? Is that something I think is, but
absolutely.
Because you know, most of the programs teach cognitive, one form of cognitive behavioral.
I mean, if you're asking me, 100%, my entire practice is spirituality based.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned cognitive behavior therapy. That is absolutely the rage of the moment, you know, in terms of insurance, reimbursement, all this kind of stuff. And it's not very oriented. I just want to tell you a brief vignette that you asked about spiritual. So, I don't know, a bunch of years ago, I was very interested in... do people, when they're taking a history, get demographic data, you know, 42-year-old single white male, the carpenter. I was seeing this in my students in the residency program, that there was almost never any religious, nobody would ever even say what religious, you know, tradition somebody was brought up in. So I took a year's worth of psychiatric journals to just see what this was in the 80s. I did, or maybe it's a bunch of years, like 35 years ago. I don't think it's changed though, because I see this in the residence. And I looked at any text that was more than like a paragraph to see if religious identification was mentioned. And it was only mentioned when it was pathological or something weird. So it would be like, I mean, we're children of Holocaust survivors. We're not pathological or weird, but that would be one of the demographic things, you know, blah, 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 child of Holocaust survivors, blah, 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 ex nun, blah, 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 you know, former Mormon, something like that. So there is, you know, historically, there is a bias against thinking of spirituality as actually a category of valid human achievement. You know, I mean, I did train psychoanalytically, so I have a lot of gratitude towards that. But the whole sort of Freudian love work, you know, love, sex, death, didn't really have play, didn't really have spirituality. I think that a competent therapist in the here and now ought to be attuned to this. It, you know, the corollary to your question is, does my therapist need to be the same religion as me? And I would say theoretically not. Because somebody should be respectful of faith and spirituality if they're a good, decent psychotherapist. That isn't always the case, however.
The final question, I'm finding a lot of people in different conferences on psychedelic psychotherapy.
Yes.
And you were talking about just problem with psychedelics. So if you could speak, where do you see that going?
I mean, I was seeing it as a phenomenon. I don't think we know yet if it's a problem. I think that this is probably an unbelievably explosive area of interest. And I know that there are billions of dollars waiting to invest in clinics to do all this kind of stuff. I mean, the person I wrote a book several years ago called The Art of Jewish Pastoral Counseling, Routledge. And my co-author is Dr. Rachel Yehuda, who's like the queen of PTSD. And she is the neurobiology of PTSD. It's related to psychedelics, and she's super involved in psychedelic research. I think it's an avenue of enormous opportunity and potential enormous abuse, because it seems to like fast track in a way the opportunity for access and then consolidation of psychologic exploration. But you can also have, like I said, a lot of crash and burns. I mean, you can have people, it's like, you know, we've all seen young people like late teens, early 20s have terrible psychotic experiences on weed. That doesn't happen for the vast majority of people, but for the people it does happen for, it can really ruin their lives. So I think it's powerful, and we don't know yet, you know, what the consequences are going to be. And we're also dealing, apropos of stigma, with the stigma of the 1960s, which is in all of our heads, you know, like, wow, this stuff is really toxic and dangerous and terrible. So I think, the jury is out on that one.
Thank you.
All right. I just wanted to add one more sentence. Social workers are taught to do a biopsychosocial spiritual assessment. So it is definitely a huge part of the work that we do. We teach it to the students as much of a required course.
I've always asked patients, you know, do they have a spiritual practice, especially with mindfulness today and people meditating? And
part of our mentor.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mike, please wrap a shot.
A question for Professor Steinberg. So just wondering about the addicts. There's when we heard about the Hikmakrut, that they're sold over to the drugs, and also it's going to, even when they're coming off of it, it's going to affect the behavior and the mood. So what are some of the halachic parameters? What are they in terms of responsibility and perhaps crime and punishment, those kind of issues? People that are addicted, let's say, to drugs, to alcohol.
Well, I think this is a very ambivalent and complex approach. On the one hand, we know the law of Ben Sorero More. Ben Sorero More is being punished prior to him becoming an addict, in order for him not to be an addict. How to understand, according to the Gemara, there was never a Ben Sorero More, but the concept is that prevention is preferable over treatment. If you see a tendency that goes towards one of these addictive behaviors, it's preferable to identify it early, either punish or educate, depending on how you want to handle Ben Sorero More. But the concept is that prevention is more important than treatment. Once someone is already within this saga, then obviously everything has to be done possible to take him out of it. But here again, alcohol, to become an addict or even to become a shikor, even on a one-time basis, is viewed very negatively, halachically. On the other hand, there are so many mitzvahs of drinking wine. And where do you draw the boundary between how much drinking for a mitzvah is okay and for non-mitzvah is not okay? Think about Arba Koises on Pesach. I can't drink 4 koises of wine. I'm getting all mixed up. So I'm mixing with grape juice. But the halacha is you drink 4 koises. I'm not talking about Purim. Again, Purim, according to the Ramah at least, you don't have to drink to become so intoxicated that you don't know to distinguish between Ahur Haman and Baruch Mordechai. According to the Ramah, you drink a little more and you go to sleep. And while you sleep, you don't know to distinguish between Ahur Haman and Baruch Mordechai. That's a way to be mekayim the mitzvah and yet not to overdo it. There are so many mitzvahs. I'm not talking about a kiddush, what do you call it? A kiddush klap. But Kiddush is to drink a cup of wine. Avdola is to drink a cup of wine. Sheva Borches is to drink a cup of wine. Berches HaMozen is to drink a cup of wine. So if you sum up all the cups of wine that you are mechuyev to do, where do you draw the line? So it is very clearly that from a philosophical point of view, the halacha distinguishes clearly between abusing and fulfilling the mitzvah, and even medically, there is some benefit to wine from a medical point of view if it's done in the right way. Now, substance abuse, interestingly, at least written tshuvas on that issue, there are hardly any. There's a short tshuva by Moshe Feinstein that the drug abuse is absolutely against the Torah, and he brings all kinds of psychological and social reasons why not, but not a clear aloche because it's so reasonable. So again, I'm saying that certainly halacha would prefer to educate against becoming an addict rather than having the person addict and try to treat him and get him out of it. But it's, as I say, it's not a simple one-side mirror.
And if, thank you. And if they're already an addict and they're trying to improve themselves and they're feeling guilty about not having done this mitzvah, about missing davening, et cetera, am I allowed as a physician to tell them that they're putter, they're working on themselves? In other words, there may be people better than me to evaluate the patients, but right now they're seeing me. You know, I'm the family doctor, let's say, their clinic doctor. And so I'm the only one that they're turning to for advice. And this is sort of making them feel more guilty and causing consequences that were unintended, and they're trying to come off their substances.
Well, I think in general, in halacha, A, you have to have a kavonah to do the mitzvah, and if you are in such a situation, you're probably doing it just as an automatic deed. So it's not worth much from a real halachic point of view. But there are many such situations. An obsessive compulsive person who washes 50 times, you can tell him, don't wash at all, in order to him to get into the mood that you wash once. And if you forgot, you forgot. But it's not simple for someone who has tendencies to do something which is addictive or is psychiatric or is socially unacceptable. I think it's very individualized. You have to see who the person is, how will he feel if he won't be mekayim the mitzvah, how will it help him. It's very individual. I don't think there's a rule on it.
So first of all, I thought my husband was going to ask me a question. I was freaking out. But since he asked the question, anyways, I think it's actually a really interesting point because I do work about 98% of my practice is within the ultra-Orthodox and Hasidic community. And people ask me all the time, well, I can't go daven and I don't feel well. First of all, when a person is in recovery from substance abuse or a behavioral addiction, the body really does undergo changes and it really is a recovery process. We also know that the four triggers for addiction is what we call halt, hungry, angry, lonely, tired. And I tell my clients all the time, sleep. You can't get to minion, that's fine. Sleep, take care of yourself, eat, sleep, and rest. As far as 12-step meetings, I've spoken to many Rabbanim, and I will send my clients to meetings on Shabbos and Yantiv. They go with a non-Jewish driver, and then they come back because it is absolutely, there's not a question in my mind, it's pikuach nefesh. Yantiv is an excruciatingly difficult time for people in early recovery. There's huge financial pressures, family pressures, and they can't handle it. Rabbi Dr. Abraham Tversky, again, had the best example. He said, when you take somebody in early recovery, he said, imagine yourself in a New York City skyscraper and you're going into the elevator at 8:30 in the morning and you're rushing in and everybody's there and kind of mushed together. And there's this guy standing next to you in a long trench coat. You kind of brush up against him accidentally and he starts screaming in pain. You're like, okay, like what happened? Rabbi Tversky said, but now imagine he has a horrible burn over his entire body. And any touch is just going to send him into huge pain. Well, people that have addiction have been numbing their emotions for years and years and covering it with substance and behavior. It's the first time they're actually feeling things. They're overwhelmed. They can't handle it. And when you put a 3-day yantiv, we should all make aliyah, and you have that huge finances and the family and the people who hate them. Yeah, go to a meeting. Definitely. Our numbers are so big now in the community that people are forming meetings within Orthodox communities on Shabbos and Yantiv within walking distance. So I send my clients there. But if there's no choice, it's a disease. And if you relapse, you're going to be in big trouble and you can die. So I let them go. I spoke to rabbis, but I've let them go anyways. Can I still come home with you? We're good? Okay.
Just interested in the idea that trauma is underlying a very high percentage of addiction disease, but we know that trauma also is underlying many other psychiatric disorders. And you were speaking about the biological component of that issue. What kind of research is being done to sort of tease that out, to sort of say, okay, this person's going to become an addict, this person's going to become bipolar? Is anything happening in that way?
I don't know if there's research about it, but we do know that addiction
is the perfect combination of nature and nurture. There's definitely a genetic predisposition or a genetic built-in protection as to how your brain is wired, but you cannot discount what happens to the person and the trauma that affects it. And we know that trauma affects many parts of the brain, and people will do anything to kind of soothe themselves and make themselves feel better. So I don't know the particular studies, but there is definitely a huge connection.
Okay, we'll take a little bit of a break. You can continue the discussion formally. The second session of Mental Health will be here too, and I don't know exactly 15, 20 minutes. We'll announce it, and refreshments next door, and say hello to somebody, and good luck. Thank you very much, Rishi Pua.